Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's wasting time. Everybody
stands in line. Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Wednesday, May 6th, and it is a beautiful, typical 42 degree New England spring day. And I'm very pleased to be welcoming Daryl Becker back to the show. Daryl is a good friend of mine. I've known him for many, many years. We are in a mastermind group together. We've been doing that for almost 5 years. So we talk every week. And we've also done a number of productions together through the years. The most relevant one to what you're about to listen to was recorded back in 2015. It was a four-part series called Scientific Consensus versus Dissent. You will probably hear that referenced several times in our upcoming conversations. And I would still recommend going and listening to that. You can go to schoolsucksproject.com and just search for Daryl Becker or search for Scientific Consensus, and you will find it. Daryl and I have had several private chats over the course of the last couple months. Daryl has a perspective currently on this whole situation that we've been talking about that differs from a lot of what you've been hearing on the show. It differs from mine. And recently, in one of our private conversations, I think this was early last week, he challenged me on a statement that I had been making repeatedly. And I wasn't thinking carefully enough about what I was saying or what this statement meant. We're going to talk about it early on in our conversation today, but I'll just give it to you in a nutshell here too. It's kind of like the idea, because I don't have a scientific background, I am forgoing knowledge and understanding on a huge piece of this whole coronavirus situation, the science of it. And by doing that, it also kind of relegates the show to a position of ignorance on this topic, saying there's so many factors here, let's just focus on other things. So I wanted to include Daryl's perspective, which again is unique from many of the ones you have already heard in this ongoing conversation. And I was also aiming to use these upcoming discussions as a kind of model, or at the very least an inspiration for those who are seeking some level of empowerment in understanding certain aspects of this situation, even if we don't wind up all agreeing in the end. Imagine that. And, you know, that empowerment, I feel like I should state this explicitly because obviously this is a controversial subject, could come from some door we open up for you, some new realization from something that's presented here, or from something that you completely disagree with or object to, and that leads to discoveries of its own, as is the case with all the content we produce. I think right now I'm estimating this is going to be split into about 4 episodes. Today's show is an introduction, and we'll deal with a lot of bigger picture stuff. As we've talked about in recent shows, there's a lot of promotion right now of either-or choices. And an important one that Daryl points out is what he calls agnosticism versus addiction to certainty. So we'll explore what that means. And that actually moves us into another topic, division. The more addicted people are to certainty, the more, like, let's imagine there's like a kind of divide and conquer scheme going on here. Let's imagine it's been going on for years. Those seeking to divide and conquer have a much easier time when there is a widespread suffering from that type of addiction. Now, the title of this series, as you know, I like to get a lot of mileage out of words and phrases like school sucks. And this is a test is no exception. It has lots of different meanings. Many will be hinted at in this initial conversation, but expanded on in future episodes. Obviously, this time is a unique test for all of us. And with tests come opportunities. If there wasn't an opportunity in what's going on, we really don't need to do a show about it. I did a show recently that I loved while I was doing. I still love. I'm still really happy with the conversation. I was on Free Man Beyond the Wall with Pete Canones. This was all the way back on April 26th. So that's like a week and a half ago. And I hung up with Pete and I went, damn, that was fiery. And so I'm getting ready to repost it yesterday. And I listened back to it. And I'm like, good heavens, I sound like I'm about to eat my neighbors here. So why would I inflict angry 10 days ago me on you sweet, sweet folks today, even if I loved it, if I felt like I wasn't being in some way constructive. So even though everything that we talk about here is not going to be easy to listen to, and some of the things that we will consider are not going to be a handful of Xanax, I did see a real opportunity for me in what was a very challenging and at times discomforting conversation, and I hope there will be an opportunity in this for you too. But there are larger opportunities that Daryl and I will also discuss. So I mentioned agnosticism in our flexibility. We will also get a little fanciful. I will ask Daryl to run through his best and worst case scenarios based on the research he has done of what is happening right now. In the second episode, we'll talk a little bit about Daryl's goals and methods for our continuing conversation, the germ versus terrain theory of disease, the scientific processes that are used to establish strong evidence for a microorganism being the major cause of a set of symptoms. We'll go all through the history of that, including some recent discoveries and controversies. We will look at some academic papers that we believe there are some problems with, and we'll eventually wind our conversation down by trying to take a closer look at and hopefully simplify, it is a tall order to simplify this, the RT-PCR tests that have been used to establish these very high numbers of coronavirus cases around the country and obviously around the entire world. We'll also ask if a preponderance of false positive or false negative test results even matter now that new information has come forward that hundreds of thousands of people might have had the virus without ever even knowing it. So that's what's coming up, and I will probably drip those shows out one per week over the course of the rest of May and maybe into June because these shows are dense and it is a very, very busy month for me. For a man who is just supposed to be sitting at home, I have a rather expansive non-School Sucks itinerary that takes me to several different places over the next 30 days. But how about I just tell all of you about it when it's over? Now, because I just ran through a list of topics that we're going to be covering here, I might have scared some people, and I understand that. And I want to assure you that we do not intend to be conclusive and certainly not prescriptive. Think of this as a research discussion. I say not prescriptive because I totally understand that everybody is dealing with this situation differently. Everybody has their own set of concerns and liabilities. This is an ongoing conversation. After you listen to today's show, please feel free to send feedback and questions. You know, I'm having a lot of questions myself over here. As is the case, obviously, everybody, with so many worthwhile self-directed learning types of pursuits. The more you learn, the more questions sort of unfold in front of you, the further away you realize the horizon actually is. I remember like 20 years ago when I learned three chords on the guitar and I was like, wow, I should start a band. And I really don't recommend such a reductive, self-assured kind of approach to a global pandemic and all of the possible results of it. But shit, that approach sure is super popular right now. I've really tried to take a broad approach to this and take in information from lots of different sources to pay attention to what, a little too much attention, and it gets a little irritating, paying attention to the narrative most people are supposed to believe. So what's coming through CNN and all of the supporting media and who they're choosing to amplify, etc. But when we see the appearances of people like Dr. Dan Erickson, this urgent care doctor in Bakersfield, California, who obviously got tons of attention over the last 2 weeks for speaking out, saying that the government had a disproportional response, to integrate that into everything that I'm learning in a picture that I'm trying to put together, and also recognizing that I need to be kind of guarded because I know it's going to be my impulse to jump into the camp of the person saying the different thing. But just because somebody is saying something drastically oppositional to, Bill Gates or the talking head on CNN or MSNBC or the shithead comedians who just kind of parrot that narrative and combine it with laughter to really make it sink in, even if somebody goes hard against that grain, that needs to be scrutinized too. I need to remember that with my little emotions about all of this. We used to talk years and years ago on this show about how you stop people from thinking logically by forcing them to think emotionally, and later we learn that those two things are very, very intertwined. So the conspiratorial me gets all excited over the last couple of days because everybody is posting this I don't know if it's a trailer or an excerpt or it's the whole movie. It's called Plandemic, and it's this doctor, right? Judy Mikovits is her name. And I watched this video. She's got a very compelling alternative kind of conspiracy theory about everything that's happening here. So my impulse is to embrace it. As I watch it, I realize she hits without knowing, all right? So this when we used to talk about the benefits of understanding logical fallacies, how a detector can go off where even if you don't have an incredible depth or breadth of knowledge on a subject, if you realize that somebody's trying to bullshit you, you know you need to take a closer look. So like logical fallacies working as a kind of like, hey, alert, pay attention to what's going on here, there are a number of like contextual considerations. Once you identify them, you know you have to proceed with like an elevated level of scrutiny. I felt this way a little bit with Dan Erickson too, even though I felt like Dan Erickson had lots of good information. I felt like he was signaling a little bit, right? Like he's doing a presentation. He's got a point of view. This is not just the objective presentation of medical information. And sure, maybe he gets like, points for honesty, for clarifying it. Like, thanks, Dan, for telling us where you stand. But by doing that and moving out of the objective, some people see him as a political ally. Now, who's interviewing him right now? The whole Tucker Carlson crowd. So if somebody sees you as a political ally, a lot of people see you as a political enemy. So you've politicized yourself by moving out of the objective, which is a problem. As the authoritarian left works very, very hard on multiple fronts day in and day out, especially through this situation, to divide the world into only two camps, the responsible versus the retarded, which ironically is literally retarding and totally retarded. But this Dr. Judy Mikovits hits a bunch of these contextual red flags for me, which obviously means that even if I'm attracted to a message, it requires a much closer look. I want to believe this story. It's all over all of my news feeds. But the three red flags that concern me are she appears seemingly out of nowhere, number one, with a complete picture, with a total explanation of what is happening. That's number two. And number three, she has a story that involves a whole bunch of powerful people that she, at various points from what I've gathered so far, in her career was indeed involved with. But even if the conspiracy against her is true, when someone says all of these powerful interests conspired directly against me, it can certainly, just as far as perception is concerned, poison the message or poison the person, which obviously is a logical fallacy. But sorry, we live in a world where logical fallacies are employed frequently and very successfully as weapons against various messages. If somebody's presentation includes this idea that a bunch of powerful people conspired against me, you want to be careful. If that's the person that you're going to push out there as a source, what you're going to be met with, right or wrong, is obviously this is just some sort of paranoid delusion or narcissistic fantasy. I mean, after all, who do you think you are that there'd be all this high-level coordination to deal with you? That doesn't mean outright dismissal of her whole story. What it means, I would say, my advice would be, proceed cautiously before sharing. Look, regardless of what the truth is, you push something out there like this, you say, here, watch this 30-minute video. It explains everything. Damn, that must be the most efficient 1,800 seconds in history. And to your opponent, if the conclusion comes with a person, all you have to deal with is the person. Get rid of them. And the conclusions disappear. So think of it as a starting point for what you want to share, not the end point of what you want to share. And that's great advice from me. I also mentioned things appearing in my newsfeed. Should that really be called a newsfeed? When I was on with Pete Quinones, I love that show, go listen to it. I talked about, for most people, I mean, I'm not saying this applies to everybody, maybe you're really good about this, but for most people, even if we tell ourselves a story about how we're going to get news, the process of news acquisition is now inextricable from opinion. The absence of objectivity, and I know like it's very trite to just say, oh, social media is a bad thing, it's making us more apart. Nothing shows up in any of these places if somebody hasn't already decided that it can be used to bolster a point of view that they already have. There might be exceptions, but almost nobody that I interact with online is using their newsfeed as an objective curation of information. And that's very important to remember, because I think there's a subtle effect of that when we keep seeing things over and over again in our little scrolls. We might start to subtly and hastily lend credence to these things that we keep seeing over and over again without even realizing we're doing it. I don't think that's a really conscious process, but it's dangerous. This leads to like a lot of really challenging reconciliations that need to take place. Like, obviously, I think the government response is insane. So now you have a chorus of people, a lot of people who we're friendly with here, saying, oh, look, it's all overblown. And I tend to agree. So I have to ask, did the part where everybody stayed inside for almost 60 days, did that contribute to these numbers leveling off? I don't know. And I don't know if there isn't some completely alternative explanation. I'm not even considering at this point. But I do know this, and I'm not even a doctor, and I still know this, that if you're worried about public health and immunity from a virus, here's a bad idea. Put everybody in their homes in a high state of anxiety, rob them of human connection, have them engage in solar distancing. Because who needs exposure to that thing, right? It causes cancer. But don't worry, they can get all the light they need from staring into screens, which now, for unfortunately millions of people, is their only source of human connection. Take them away from environments that contain the germs that their immune systems use as a kind of gym or fitness center. Oh, all of those are also closed, by the way. I'm sure there is still somehow 600 people in the LA Fitness I used to go to right now. Based on my experience, I just can't stretch my imagination to the point where I can picture that building empty. This lockdown has deprived so many people of average resourcefulness, of so many behavioral and holistic, positive health practices that I hate to say a lot of things that I say. But what's going to happen when all these newly immune deficient people are allowed to wander back into the world whenever that's happening, this week, next week? And I'm not saying it shouldn't. So how about we bring in a guest, huh? Get his thoughts on all of this. My friend Daryl Becker is a holistic health practitioner. He has 20 plus years of experience in a variety of capacities, including a teaching capacity. If you like what Daryl has to say, or you fucking hate what Daryl has to say, but it gets you thinking, you can learn more about him and you can check out his work at notmedicaladvice.co. Daryl is building a really informative collection of shows, interviews, and resources there. And one of the most important things that Daryl does at Not Medical Advice is helping people who are in a higher state of ignorance than they would like to be about their health find the professionals that can best help them and best match with them for their current, more importantly, for their chronic conditions. So it's not just about what do you need to know. It's also about, damn, this is so important. I learned this last year. What you need to ask. In the year 2019, I had a few doctor's appointments. I had some problems. That sciatic nerve thing that was really, really cramping my style. Those visits often seem like very hasty, very high pressure, at times hostile. But if you go in there armed with information and the questions you need to ask these people, you are in a much better position to get the help you actually need. Daryl consulted me last year when this happened. If you're already really skeptical about Eastern medicine, you're thinking he told me to put like garlic between my toes or whatever, and then I just got a placebo effect. You're wrong. Part of it was supplementation, but also it was determined that the best course of action was to see a specialist, and that solved the problem. So if last year, like last summer, the doctor's office seemed like a rushed and high-pressure situation, I assure you, you will not be seeing improvements with that this coming summer. Daryl also has a YouTube channel. You can just go and search YouTube for Not Medical Advice. It's a new channel, so go subscribe, huh? One of my favorite things to do is when we have a guest on the show who has a new, maybe a small YouTube channel or podcast, but lots of great contributions to make. We get together, you and me, and we get them more listeners and subscribers. So please go subscribe to Daryl's YouTube channel. Please, let's make this an interactive process. So send us your feedback, send us your questions. You can do it in the School Sucks group. You can contact us directly. And I hope you enjoy this series that plays out over the next several weeks. And after that, I promise we'll move into 3 solid months of UFO and Hornet stuff. All right, here we go.
So
Daryl, welcome back.
Brett, it's so great to be back.
We've got a real marathon ahead of us here. And I was thinking about it before we started. Is this going to be the most sensible show that we've done in this topic area? Is it going to be the most controversial show? Is it going to be both? It's okay if it's neither. Man, when I looked at the notes and the research that I put together for this show, I was just so energized and excited. And I want to say I really appreciate you for prompting me to take a closer look at a lot of aspects of this whole situation. And this kind of relates to something that we did together in the past. We had a four-part series called Scientific Consensus versus Dissent. And this, I think in many ways, even though we're applying it to the current situation, this is going to be a kind of extension of that.
I was thinking the exact same thing. This is going right into the realm of what exactly is, I would say, a more accurate or a way to get better predicted and desired results using science. What's the way of doing that? So the way I think of it as you take with a premise, whoever's got the premise, and you try to prove it wrong. Or you try to find what is the supportive evidence at least to start with. That's kind of the place I started when I was looking into this question.
So we've done a lot of content on this topic. We've covered it from a variety of angles, and I've tried to make them all applicable to what we're all about here at School Sucks. Analyzing current events or communication. Now we're taking it more from the critical thinking angle. But I've been meaning to have your voice heard in this conversation for a while, and I know you've been listening, so I just wanted to gather your impressions of the conversation that we've had so far on this topic.
Well, your show compared to many other shows, at least there's less of hysteria and there's less of the firm certainty that I find myself kind of allergic to.
So, right, yeah.
I mean, it really gets me itchy and sneezy when I hear people really, really certain that the virus came from here and the infection numbers are this and the death numbers are these. And basically, people who claim they know it's a hoax, and there's those who claim they know it's a biological weapon. And they're so firm about these conclusions. I'm glad that it's less of that, of what I was hearing, but they still came back to the same base conclusions. So I did get a little, I get sad and frustrated when I was hearing about all the measures of precautions, dipping your shoes in bleach or how much to wear gloves and mask and wipe everything down with toxic things like Lysol.
We've done a lot of better safe than sorry over the last couple months. That's for sure.
Yeah. And that's that part, it's not like I don't get it in all the other shows I listen to. it's in everything. But I mean, it really started me thinking, where would I start? This is like a forensic activity. Who done it? A virus was blamed for these symptoms and diseases and deaths. Okay, I'd like to see some evidence, please.
And we're going to get into all that. That's a wonderful preview of what we have coming up. The reason why I asked you that is we were having a private conversation, and I thought you made a really important point. This was maybe about a week ago. You said, why do you keep saying this is, I'm not, I feel like it, that's just like a meme right now. Like, quote, I'm not an epidemiologist, unquote, everybody. Everybody is prefacing almost so much of what they say with that. I'm not a virologist. I'm not an epidemiologist. And, what you said to me is, why do you keep speaking about how you're incapable of understanding what's going on here? Or maybe even if I give it a shot and it turns out for whatever reason I am incapable of understanding, it seems like a lot of people that we're being asked to trust are apparently incapable or maybe even unwilling to understand what's actually going on here. But it made me think, right? Because if we're doing a show about a certain level of empowerment through critical thinking, if I keep saying that, it kind of goes against our main message. And I think the clarification that I wanted to make is there's lots of factors here, right? There's lots of things in play. There's the health side of it, right, which we're going to talk about today. But then there's government response. There's economic implications, personal liabilities, potentially. And there are social liabilities. The only thing that we've really felt so far, by and large, most of us, is the government response. And it has a lot of us going, well, wait a minute, this certainly seems disproportional. And it makes a lot of us agitated and it makes a lot of us suspicious. But given all of the things that are going on here, I said, all right, well, where can I best direct my energy? Where can I not get lost? Where can I, you know, my sphere of control type stuff like we've been talking about on this show forever. But you were right that that was worth, especially in the beginning, when there were so many unknowns, and I showed up where I am now in New Hampshire, whatever it was, almost 7 weeks ago, with very little information, very uneasy about a lot of what was happening, right? That uncertainty, that ignorance really definitely created some anxiety. So I think that might have been part of what you were speaking to. But yeah, I want to resolve that the best I can. And I know I might not get definitive answers, but at least like going through the exercise of trying to learn more instead of just like closing that door and worrying about other things. I think I am ready and I have been ready and I have, you know, changed my approach a little bit. So I appreciate the encouragement.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to say what you were acknowledging right there is just the beginning first steps to try to understand what's going on. And I was just talking to my girlfriend this morning about it, and she was describing how, you know, like she just fears that she's like does not have the acumen to actually look deep into what's going on, and it just seems far too confusing, and like it would take too much time. That would be the main part. It would take too much time to look at a study. It would take too much time to look at a PCR test. It would take too much time to study the postulates or other things that we're going to cover in the shows that we're coming up here, and that the first step is to acknowledge, you know, like what you're doing. You don't need to be a virologist or an epidemiologist. You don't need to go through that traumatic training that we covered in Disciplined Minds.
Yep.
You know, you don't need to do that. You can skip right to actually the basis of what these things are. You know, that's why everything is out there to learn. And it is very important to step into the fear of uncertainty. That's really, really important because it's the desire for certainty is where you get beliefs being born, firm religious conclusions that would not be yielding to evidence because you want to believe them to be true or you want a certain type of authority to be right because you've basically pinned it on that. You know, there's that quote about it's very hard to explain something to someone if their salary depends upon them not understanding it.
Yeah.
You know,
we're going to get into that too. We're going to have to talk about doctors during this conversation, so it's going to come up again. But please, yes, whatever you'd like to say now, go for it.
Well, I was going to speak to the average person's certainty, not to necessarily to the doctor yet. But
right.
It's really hard to explain what I'm going to go over today and the shows with you on this topic to someone who has an emotional salary tied to a belief system. And they're not going to very easily want to understand it if their salary means that all of the emotional support from all the people who believe the same thing that they do, that they interact with, they're getting basically emotional dividends from being connected to those people. If they fear for a moment that they could disconnect from any of those people or all of them by flexing their mind, by having flexibility and curiosity to go into an area of what if, then they're literally going to shut down. They'll have those three Fs, fight, flight, or freeze. And that's the problem right there is a lot of people are going to go ahead and do that. Obviously, your show is not for those people. Your show is for people who are open-minded and want to push the envelope of their belief systems. They are going to question things by and large. But there are going to be people, of course, in your audience who don't want to question things. And they are going to want to jump to say, you know, straw man me with certain, like, as if I believe certain things. I don't. I'm really questioning about, you know, not really believing much at all. I'm very much agnostic. I don't know. But, you know, for the moment of taking action, and we covered this in that series of scientific, you know, consensus versus dissent, that the point would be, I want to get an idea for the best possible actions that I can take. And that's like in others, and for action based, I do the best I can. And after I do that, now it's academic. And now I'm open to questioning everything, including how I could have just gotten it wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, that kind of agnosticism and uncertainty, as I've discussed with many people, they seem really kind of unfamiliar with that. So just to get people to step into the idea that you can be uncertain And indeed, that's the part of being a scientist or being scientific, empirically at least, is that you're not certain, because in this moment we're academic, we're discussing things. I don't know what's going on. I'm trying to figure it out just like you, Brett. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to take my time, going to go over things. And at the moment of action, like, do I need this mask on? Do I need to sanitize my hands? Am I in danger from a pathogen? That's the point where I'm going to say the best knowledge I have is based, it equals this. And then I go and I revisit. Is there new evidence that shows that I could have chosen wrong? And, right. and that's kind of what I'm talking about. It's a whole new thing. But if you, like, now I'll touch on the doctor thing. If you have had a certain conclusion for a long period of time and you've been certain about it, and now I'm trying to help you maybe understand that there's new evidence that you were not aware of before, maybe some, I would say, research papers that are missing. And this evidence could call into question a lot of what you've actually done, that you may have indeed caused minor to major tragedies based upon having the wrong information and making the wrong conclusions. Well, now you're going to probably find a new way to not think about or believe what I'm about to say. You're going to find ways to impugn the evidence that I'm going to bring forward, and of course, to support the evidence that keeps you in the same place of being right or correct. Because there's that, you know, cognitive dissonance kind of thing, wanting to preserve being right, and all of the dividends, the people that you're connected to, your job, your colleagues, your family, your friends, if all of that is lined up to say, I really want my connections, so I'm just going to be like sticking my fingers in my ear while Daryl's talking, because that way I can preserve the conclusions that I have. And I've encountered this many, many times with many subjects.
All right. So just to clarify, you just used the word conclusions, but what you're saying is that you try to maintain a footing where conclusions can change very easily when necessary, right? You kind of set this up as an agnosticism versus what you're encountering and what you said you were kind of allergic to, this addiction to certainty, that there's a craving for certainty as like a foundation to stand on in a very anxiety inducing situation. And people double down or firm up their position once they feel like it's being challenged. I can relate to that a little bit, even though I've been agnostic on many parts of this. I don't feel entirely agnostic. I feel like we definitely live in a world that has changed and is not going back to the way it was before, but I'm hoping I'm wrong. I would be delighted if I was wrong, and I'd say I'm pretty much agnostic on every other aspect of this.
Yeah, and I want to touch it back to the title of the show, because school likely was one of those places that many of us learned to really crave that certainty. We raise our hand and we say the answer and the teacher smiles and, you know, things go our way and we might even get a reward. We raise our hand, we say the wrong answer and the teacher corrects us and people might laugh at us. So there was this craving for certainty that I'm making a theory right there, just a theory, not a firm conclusion, that's where it happened in many of us at that formative, very vulnerable age, you know, spending all of those 15,000 hours and constantly getting rewarded by being certain. And uncertainty, or being like, I would say, putting forth a minority opinion that indeed was proclaimed to be wrong by the authority figure, well, that is punished to some degree, whether like by laughter or other types of punishments. And that's really important that this goes way back for most people, that type of training. The whole approach to this is, it's very much practical for me. Like, I have to do this when I'm practicing as an acupuncturist. Holistic healthcare is what I do. So a client comes in and I need to do diagnostics, and I need to quickly, because there's a time limit, come up with a treatment plan. And I feel very certain that I have the right treatment plan at that moment that I'm implementing it. I have learned, and I've also been conditioned to desire the certainty, but I've also reconditioned myself to be very questioning right as soon as I'm done. I'm looking for evidence to see, did I get it wrong? I certainly want to make sure that I don't make things worse. That's part of the Hippocratic Oath that I took. I want to make sure that I am indeed going along with the goals of the client and myself. you know, that they are in, hopefully in unison. I try to make sure of that when we discuss things in the first part of the client and you know, myself when I'm working things out. As soon as I'm done with the action, that's where everything goes back into the academic realm of questioning. I could have gotten it wrong. And on the cases where I did not serve a client well enough, those are the biggest areas of learning. Like, and by the way, when I don't serve someone well enough, they stop paying for me and they stop coming here because I am a cash practice. So I don't have the feedback loop that some doctors are protected by, where they keep getting paid regardless and people keep showing up because they think it's free. Or, you know, basically you think it's paid for. And it would be the same thing for you go to the mechanic because things get better, and you stop going to that mechanic because things are not getting better fast enough or they're getting worse.
Right.
And it's very, very simple like that. So the feedback, you know, it starts at the moment of, you know, I build the best case I can for my conclusions right before I take action. And then as soon as I take the action, now I'm looking to see, did I get it wrong? Where did I miss something? How could I have done it even better? You know, what were the results exactly? And I want to see the results over time too, because it's, you know, health is absurdly mysterious, unlike the mechanic who fixes my Honda, where it's extremely linear and everything stays put. Whereas on the human body, everything affects everything as far as I've been able to tell. Like, there's nothing that's disconnected. That's, of course, one of the fallacies of what is unfortunately taught in most medical schools. There's so many connections that it's just absurd. So, you know, there's no one that I know who could, you know, make the claim that they know exactly how to make it all work perfectly. It doesn't work that way. So there's a lot of uncertainty. So I've, in 22 years of practicing medicine, I've embraced uncertainty more and more. And, you know, in the time that I've spent studying critical thinking and being on your show, Brett, it's been a great journey to really step into this agnosticism.
Actually, I want to go back to something that you said a few minutes ago, where you talked about, you know, school obviously being very formative, right? People pleasing authorities with certainty. But obviously, in the dialogue that's developed in the world in the last 10 years through social media and alternative media, there's also a lot of carrots now for being rebellious. Do you know what I mean? For going against the authorities. We're seeing plenty of that right now. People's desire for certainty seems to be just as apparent there. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's pretty much just being certain of a different conclusion.
Right, really right.
That's all it really is, you know. It really doesn't embrace uncertainty if it's just being firm on a different conclusion. Like I mentioned, with the people who say the whole thing is a hoax and there is no virus, compared to the folks who say the whole thing for sure is a biological weapons event going on. You know, they're both really firm on their conclusions, neither of which are, of course, the popular view. The popular view, as far as I can tell, seems to be that the whole thing is some series of unfortunate accidents starting in China.
Well, let's actually lay out your scenarios, because I've heard this is I quoted you in an earlier episode of my show as my friend Daryl said,
yeah,
if this whole thing is fake, that's bad. That's not a relief, right? If this is the plandemic or the scam debt, whatever words people are using for it, that's not the best case scenario. So I'd like to hear you elaborate a little bit. Well, you've gathered a lot of information and you've laid out some scenarios that are possible here. So let's talk where you're at now. I know you talked about this with Shane, but that was almost a month ago. Shane Radliff from the Vanu podcast. What are you thinking as far as like worst case scenario here and best case scenario here?
Well, okay, so the best case scenario is actually the publicly stated one, that a virus is out there causing seemingly minor amounts of death and mayhem, and governments are doing a bumbling but bad job at trying to manage this at the expense of destroying the economy and somehow, I would say, what do you call that? Coincidentally, making a variety of billionaires incredibly wealthy in the process, or $248 some billion gained in some of the top popular billionaires that are known.
In like 3 weeks. Yeah.
Honestly, I would speculate, since I like to speculate also. Trillions of dollars have been made at this point over these last several months for various parties, and trillions of dollars have been lost by a variety of people. I had to pivot. I think you've had to pivot in our approaches to our acquisitions of money and the needs that we have. Like, I mean, I'm glad we weathered this storm not so bad, but we know people that have got hit really hard by this. They lost. So the best case scenario is that it's just, they mean well, but they just did, you know, a few bad things. And coincidentally, these people made a lot of money and some people are dying and the virus is the cause. That's the best case scenario that I could think of.
Well, we could add to that too. Projections have been obviously lowered as far as case numbers and deaths.
Best case scenario.
Okay, you know? Well, still, I don't love that as the best case scenario. But, and yes, obviously, in times of great stress or economic downturn, there's always lots of opportunity to make lots of money. That's always been the way. So that's understandable as well. That doesn't imply any conspiracy in the best case scenario.
Sure.
What the F is the worst case scenario?
Well, that would be what I would be betting on, because part of the Stoic principle is I'm going to be prepared for more of the worst case scenario, not the best case scenario.
Right.
I'm going to get ready to deal with that. And that is that possibly viruses, in this instance, the SARS-CoV-2 virus does not actually cause any illness at all. And that this is a catastrophe of testing, meaning false testing, treatment, meaning actual like horrible treatment from retroviral drugs, which are known to be incredibly toxic and can kill you. Certainly intubation via a ventilator can kill you. Like large numbers of people who go on that die.
I mean, usually when people go on ventilators, it's a dire situation and they're in the ICU and they're not conscious. And it has like, once a person gets to that point, it's typically a 50-50 as far as survival rate. But they're saying in this situation, it's 80% of people who are dying.
So there's these numbers of people dying of other conditions. And there's the triple T, testing, obviously. Testing problems, meaning humongous amounts of false positives, especially if that it isn't the cause in the first place. We'll get to that. Then there's the treatment, dying of treatment. And then there's trading of diseases. The last T is trading. So people dying of, you know, certainly other conditions completely and being labeled as this. And that produces, of course, this massive hysteria, a divide and conquer. I thought that things were divided and conquered pretty, really thoroughly with the whole Trump thing, you know, that whole political divide between people, conservative and liberal, etc. That was, you know, pretty effective. But that seemed like that was the prelude to the divide and conquer between people who are afraid, you know, wearing masks and gloves and going everywhere and believing these authorities, you know, all the way. Like that type of separation, this type of potential destruction, I mean, worse things coming down the pipeline, meaning, you know, actual, like very, very potentially toxic vaccines that were not tested adequately and certainly have lots and lots of very undesirable effects that include up to including paralysis and death. You know, actual requiring said vaccines to do commerce, such as having a bank account or buying food or things like that. You know, I know this has not happened, but I'm just saying worst case scenario is this is planned. Worst case scenario, this is being in the pipeline. And then further worst case scenario is this is a dress rehearsal for further destruction, obviously the destruction of personal liberties and many people's finances. And I may as well say, I don't know for sure that is because I'm uncertain. I'm agnostic still, but I'm going to go with that. I'm going to say, let's pretend that is so, because if I prepared for the best I can for that in that scenario, at least I've not wasted my time preparing for things that aren't a problem nearly as much, because I've been in, you know, practicing medicine 22 years. I have started out thinking I'm going to get good at treating infectious disease, my own and other people's.
Yeah.
I quickly found out that's the easiest thing I get to work on. The hardest thing I get to work on is neurological conditions, especially those involving toxic chemicals and heavy metals, especially long-standing neurological conditions. And of course, certain chronic injuries that go, you know, beyond what I am capable of helping. But like the easiest things were like seeming infectious diseases on otherwise relatively healthy individuals. That was the quickest thing to learn how to help people with. Oh, like Chinese medicine, the way it's taught in an Oriental medical college, kind of excels in it. You know, it's been designed around that for literally centuries. And it's amazingly simple and effective to go in that direction. So, like I said, the worst case scenario is, you know, basically dealing with a very widespread, obviously now like a global government that's kind of showing its hand. That pretty much covers the worst and best case scenario as far as I can imagine.
Good heavens. We have lots of open loops right now. I'm going to list what they are. Divide and conquer, we just scratched the surface of that. I want to talk about that a little more. This agnosticism versus the addiction to certainty is going to be coming up throughout this entire conversation. And in the very beginning, we were talking a little bit about the test of this time, but also the opportunity to learn and to be more deliberate in lots of ways, to be more thoughtful in lots of ways through this. There's this application of a kind of pressure right now, like stakes feel higher. We might be thinking more carefully about a lot of the things that we're doing and what, obviously, what we're consuming in a variety of ways. Like, are we spraying? What are we eating? What vitamins are we getting? What chemicals are we spraying ourselves with? And related to that, what kind of media are we taking in, right? Which is also toxic in another way, I would say very much a part of our diet. But I want to go back to the best and worst case things. And I just want to get your thoughts on a couple of items that have occurred to me. I was on Free Man Beyond the Wall with Pete Quinones. We recorded last Sunday. I haven't reposted it yet. But one of the things that came up in our conversation is right now, obviously, we're seeing this compulsory promotion, and you've been on top of this as well, of a lot of unhealthy habits and a compulsory promotion, obviously, of disconnection. And I was thinking with this mask thing that I was very, very agnostic and leaning towards the side of caution right up until these words spill out of my mouth. But going out in public, right, and just thinking about the psychological impact of this, again, to relate to disconnections. What I brought up to Pete was the Stanford Prison Experiment, which you're obviously familiar with, right?
Yes,
and this was an experiment that was done roughly 50 years ago. And it was a sort of a psychological exercise to see the impact of authority by those who wield it and by those that it gets inflicted upon. So a mock prison was set up. Some people were prisoners, some people were prison guards. And there's a lot of question about the genuine nature of the Stanford Prison Experiment now. But one of the aspects of it that I thought was interesting is that the people who played the guards, Philip Zimbardo, who ran the experiment, wanted them to wear mirror sunglasses, so prisoners could not see their eyes. And one of the observations that he made based on a lot of the ways that tribes for long times had painted themselves to hide their true identity. Obviously, the Nazis did this. Lots of different types of soldiers do this before they go into battle to kind of disconnect their actions from their identity, right? Which makes it easier to act in a kind of inhuman way. That was the dark sunglasses in the prison experiment. That is the war paint going back a long time. And, you know, I was thinking, like, what does it mean with everybody having a mask on, right? Like, I don't want to call that a psyop, but it definitely has a psychological impact, right?
I would call it part of a psyop.
In the worst case.
Yeah, in the worst case scenario, which I'm prepared for.
Right.
Yeah, it's part of it. But more importantly, I try to measure impact. There's intentions and there's impact. So I can put intentions aside because I'm not the one who orchestrated this entire event, obviously. I'm the one who's watching it unfold. So I can speculate on intentions, but I'm watching impact. And the impact certainly is that disconnection that you mentioned. And there are certainly a lot of unhealthy habits of disconnection that obviously incredibly, you know, large volumes of people turning to drinking a lot more, doing a lot more of the drugs that they already were doing or new ones that they haven't done before. You know, I mean, I'm very, very lucky of where I live, a big island of Hawaii. There's still a lot of gentle aloha spirit and do what we want over here going on.
Same in New Hampshire. Yeah. Same a lot of places I'm hearing. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of places like that. I mean, the beaches, parking lots might be closed, but people are allowed to go to the beaches. Right. I think that they knew that they'd be in for a full revolt if they tried to stop people. But at the same time, they, you know, there I see everywhere around on the streets and on the beach parks, I was watching folks like, you know, like normally they spray pesticides, herbicides especially, like horrible amounts of Roundup are sprayed on this island, like all along the roads, you know, just to reduce the amount of mowing that has to happen. This is an understandable thing. Like I heard all kinds of excuses for why it has to continue. Now I'm watching them actually toxically spray on like picnic benches at the beach and all over the place, like at random places. There are those people who are just following along that type of Stanford prison experiment where they're just told to do this thing and they do it because the authority told them so. Like the people who arrested the paddleboarder who was just out there paddleboarding alone. I'm sure you might have seen something like that out there.
Yeah. Yep.
It was a well-known little news clip that popped up. And you see them obviously not in any way thinking about the reality of how important is this that we do this? Why are we doing this? You know, they weren't asking any of those questions. They were just going along with it.
To your point, like when you said they didn't close the beaches because they knew there would be a revolt. And you also mentioned this a couple minutes ago as well. Like it feels like there's a whole bunch of trial balloons in the air right now. This does seem like a test. There's lots of pieces that lead to that conclusion. How do certain types of media respond? How do people behave? How will the police go along with this? It's everywhere you look, it appears like this is a scenario, just while we're sticking with worst case stuff here, that is being tried out while the stakes are somewhat lower than what they could be. Just to go back to the divide and conquer piece, this is something that you've done a great job with this for a long time through your work, and we've talked about it certainly on this show a lot. But the empathy that's required right now to realize that not everybody is dealing with the same situation, right? And that can alter perspectives really, really dramatically. And I think for people like us, if you know, I've talked a lot recently about like the idiot versus the nurse. I don't know if you saw that picture that I posted, but that was a kind of visual programming that I thought they were really trying to make sink in that, you know, there's basically two ways that you can feel about this thing. You can be like freedom loving, Trump supporting, fat idiot, or you can be medical hero. So pick a side, America. There's no clear side to be on in the sides that have been laid out for us, which I think for a lot of people, like for you and me, there's something gratifying about that. Like, okay, well, I'm not with you and I'm not with you. And that makes me feel kind of free. But at times that can also make you feel alienated, right? There's the people who support the lockdown. Then there's people who are ready to, as the headlines of liberal publications put it, storm the Capitol as armed protesters. That was a headline that I saw. Democratic senators forced to wear bulletproof vests as armed protesters storm the Capitol. And then I had to read that article to find out it was not as dramatic, the actual scene, as what the headline suggested. One of the things that I've noticed is that encountering one group or the actions of one group through the headlines can actually push you away and towards another. And then looking at this other group, like the lockdown group, can push you back towards sympathy with the protesters. I shouldn't say you. I found this like happening to me where I saw some of the initial like anti-lockdown protests and I said, yeah, that's not how I would do it. And I said this to Pete. I said, you know, if the purpose of doing a protest like this is outreach, like why not just try to meet people halfway? If you're trying to connect with people, why not act like you have some concern, even if you don't? You know, right. Why not just take an empathetic approach to that situation? Stand 6 feet apart, wear masks. You know, they can have pithy sayings on them about how you don't like the lockdown, but like play along a little bit if you're trying to connect with people, right? If you're trying to impact people. And then when I say that, I'm like, oh, I don't like saying that. I don't like saying that.
Doesn't that sound, something's wrong about that. Well, I think you touched on it before when you mentioned it, you called it bad optics.
Yeah.
I can't help but think of this, a version of how all of this potentially, you know, in my realm of speculating, because that's a lot of what I have access to about when talking about the big picture of what's going on. All I have is speculating. I have no Daryl intelligence agency. I can't send agents out to risk their life to tell me what's going on. I'm speculating that I'd imagine that all of this is well planned out, potentially. That's the worst case scenario that I prepare for. And that they know that they're going to be divided factions. So they want to do just what you said long ago in a show. They want to jump ahead and grab the baton of each of these parades of these factions. And they want to make sure to steer it in a certain direction. They'd love to make sure they have agent provocateur in each group for sure, directing it where they want it to go. Pretty much everyone except for someone who's asking for an empathetic approach, asking for greater degrees of connection, greater degrees of patience. Like I try to, at every show that I'm doing now, every podcast appearance or personal show I do, I make an appeal for patience with all the upset people. Please do the cost-benefit analysis to see if you can afford patience with someone. But if you can, please give a little extra this month because a lot of people are very upset. And, you know, I'm asking you to become a practitioner of healthcare for them if you can afford it and help them stand up for that. Every, you know, that this is one camp that I don't think they're going to want to jump ahead of because it's too small of a camp right now. The other ones are very, I am sure that this is the thing to do. And I'm sure that we all need to lock down. And I'm sure, like, I don't care. It's all going to go back to normal. Look, this is what they do. I mean, I certainly love Nathan Frazier's camp of there's a lot of money to be made, you know?
And yeah.
I love that too, you know? I mean, but there's just a lot of solid evidence to support each of these conclusions, right? And that's what's so confusing to the average person. Where can they get their certainty back? They're like so conditioned once again for that certainty. And I'm going to start to make an appeal saying, what if you tried to stop being certain and just apply yourself to looking at what you have access to? You know, what if you stopped with that whole thing? I know it really, really does get big dividends. You get a lot of connection to the people that you love by being certain, just like they're certain, you know, like I know, you know, that's why I guess a lot of close relationships, if there's a big divide around the whole Trump issue, for example, they're, you know, generally speaking, not going to find it a long-term thing, unfortunately. This is one of those issues too. It to serve the ruling class as a divide and conquer issue has been magnificently effective. Malevolently magnificent and extremely effective. Like, I want to be a voice again to say, please find the time to have patience with other people who are upset. Find the time to connect more with people. You know, there's always a way to do that.
Before we move on, I appreciate you saying that. And I just kind of wanted to round this portion of the conversation out with maybe like a reiteration of the understanding of this situation as an opportunity. So as you have, on one hand, prepared yourself for a worst case scenario, what opportunities have you tried to cultivate and if you would recommend to other people, even if it's just very general?
I have definitely availed myself of the opportunity to connect to people who I find out are just as questioning and curious and courageous as I might fancy myself to be. As an example, I think you know that I've been sitting in men's groups for at least 5 years now. I kind of shared with you the genesis of my experimenting with that for a while. And, you know, also co-ed groups when those were available. So, you know, the organization is called the Mankind Project, and that's like a USA project, but it also has international different, like, you know, parts of it going on in about 18 different countries. But basically, each group still has they make their own rules. Each group of guys who sit together, you know, come up with their own, this is how it's going to go as far as the hard rules, and then more of like soft suggestions. And then they flow with the format, you know, kind of like what you and I are doing, where we discuss the format, and now we start to make the show. And the same thing happens. So just as an example, all of them across the whole United States, and certainly in every of the multiple groups on the four islands that it's happening over here in Hawaii, have turned to on Zoom virtual groups only, except for one. And, you know, I mean, there might be some other groups meeting on the mainland that I don't know about, but I'm in like one group we meet person to person. We still meet like my place and our friend's place. We trade back and forth, you know, have five or six guys who just basically are curious and courageous. And I think I've approached it a little bit differently, you know, like I've kind of actually tried to look at evidence, and I think I have a little bit more of a scientific like knowledge of actual virology and epidemiology than the rest of the guys I sit with. But we're there. We're sitting together. We hug when we greet each other. We hug when we say goodbye, just like you and me, Brett, whenever we get to see each other. Mm-hmm. You know, I found the clients who are not afraid to engage with me as a healthcare provider, and I engage with them and find out how they're doing. I also engage with the people who are afraid and find out, how are you doing? Do you need more of anything? You know, some of them, they do need something of something, like not necessarily me, but they're really kind of hurting. And so I give them one of the few chiropractors who's still open. And I say, yeah, here, go see this guy. He's awesome, you know, because, you know, he's worked well for me and my clients. And I get things like that. I just find out what people, basically, where's the opportunity is what people want, and then to dish that up to them. People are craving connection. They do really appreciate patience when they are upset. And, you know, people are really looking for comfort, you know. And it's unfortunate, Brett, that, like you mentioned, there's a lot of people looking for comfort in unhealthy ways, unhealthy habits being promoted by and large, lots of jokes about wine o'clock and things like that, you know, to that way of self-medicating. I try to be empathetic about that. My approach to self-medicating of any kind is to think of the person as a survivor, because someone who's really ill and on a self-destructive path, in more ill than just self-medicating, is someone who doesn't self-medicate. They're just going downhill and they don't care. They're going down. They're not doing a thing. That's a very dangerous situation. Those people would require even more help and empathy and potential resources. People who are self-medicating, it's like, oh, I get it. I'm with you. I care about you. You know, no, I'm not drinking, but I'm going to join you and I'll hang with you, you know, and whether virtual or real life like that. Just having patience and empathy to connect with more people. This is a great opportunity to show people you don't just diss them because they're in the wrong camp, that you're not like that. You know, you don't work like that. It's a great opportunity, like Nathan would say, like to go ahead and find out what people want, make them an offer, and be ready to deliver it with no hesitation. And, you know, obviously delivering exactly what you laid out for them. And that's a great opportunity right now. This is a great time to make money. I'm certainly still doing it. There's so many opportunities right now. There's like four main qualities I love to encourage in people. They are curiosity, to actually, you know, like want to know what you don't know. The flexibility, to actually consider options that you, you know, that take some actual flexing of your mind muscles and your emotional muscles to consider as possibilities. Just imagining going down the what if way of each path, right? Of the best case and worst case scenario that I just laid out, for example.
Right.
And then the humility, to acknowledge that you got it wrong. I've gotten it wrong many times. So have you, Brett, as you've acknowledged on the show. And that helps to be stronger. Humility is not to be confused with humiliation. You know, that's very important right there. And then, of course, courage, the courage to actually want to face these things and these opportunities.
I mean, when this started, I kind of looked at what laid ahead as far as content was concerned. And I was like, man, I'm about to produce a record of me making lots of mistakes. It's fine in your personal life and to acknowledge them, but as a podcaster, it's a little bit trickier. And I've always said, like I've said it in the mastermind, and I've probably said it even on the show before, I look at people who like chase the news and I say, my show's never going to be a record of me hysterically reacting to things that don't matter 3 months later. Well, we found a thing that matters 3 months later. But I did at the beginning also realize that there is going to be some like reactive and emotional moments along the way to doing this. But I appreciate your laying out those values as guides. I think that's really important.
Yeah, they are opportunities to build up in yourself higher degrees of curiosity. Now you're going to consider you know, the best case scenario that I laid out, the worst case scenario. You're going to consider some of the evidence that I'm looking for, because I'm not here to push an actual conclusion. I'm here asking for help finding evidence. That's part of the show, right? Yeah. So I'm actually looking for the flexibility to consider different potential conclusions, different outcomes right there. I want that. I'm looking for humility. I'm trying to raise my own humility all the time. I've certainly done plenty in my life to, you know, need to do that, you know, because of failure, unfortunately. But, you know, some of that was actually successful, meaning it helped me grow as a person to acknowledge that I got it wrong, that other people could be getting it wrong. And I want, you know, I want the listener out there to acknowledge that there's the space of growth to know that you could have gotten it wrong. And finally, to have the courage to step forward and ask questions. You know, it takes courage to have that curiosity, to have that type of flexibility against, say, what your emotional dividends gain from, you know, keeping what your tribe all thinks, basically. Mm-hmm. To have the humility to acknowledge that your tribe could be wrong, therefore you could be wrong, you know. All of that does take courage, you know. And, you know, the opposite of those things are, of course, like firm and fixed conclusions, opposite of curiosity. That's definitely the opposite of flexibility too. I'm really trying to go for the opposite, saying it's okay if you've come from a place of the firm fixed conclusion, and it's okay if you feel uneasy because you're going against what your tribe thinks, what your partner or your workers, or like your coworkers, your family. It's okay to step into that, because it doesn't mean that you have to separate from those people if you get clever with it. It's really going to take some courage to do that.
All right. So two more questions as we round out this hour of the conversation. First, I want to hear you talk a little bit about your social media approach, because we're friends on Facebook, and I notice I've been doing this more too. You post a lot of conversation starters, we could call them.
Yeah.
What results have you gotten?
I'm finding who's my audience. Who am I connecting to? Because I've been slow to really post the shows that I'm making on my channel on YouTube, not medical advice. I've been really slow to do that. Like, I haven't done it yet because, you know, I'm trying to up my production values more, and I'm trying to hone my message and get used to making productions. But I'm seeing who likes my messages, and what do they want from me? What do they like from me? Mm-hmm. So people like to laugh, and yet they like to think. And that's like, hey, we've got something in common. I also like things that both make me think and laugh at the same time. You know, like the one that I got the most reactions to was this meme where you got this guy drinking a beer kind of out on his porch in front of all his houseplants. And I see people driving alone in their car wearing a mask. I wonder if they lay in bed alone wearing a condom. You see, that just gets you to thinking. I'm not trying to...
Are you not supposed to do that?
No. Yeah, I know. So... what it makes me think about, like, the utility of wearing a mask, right? Because obviously wearing a condom alone in bed seems ridiculous. So what is the point of driving in your sealed up vehicle wearing a mask? You know, what is that doing? And, you know, I have not posted a single damn thing about what necessarily the veracity of how masks could or could not prevent an infectious disease from either bacteria or viruses. Because I just didn't, you know, sometimes I just don't feel like that. And those are the posts that get very little reactions. I'm looking to see who has things to say, what gains the most comments, what kind of things gain discussions between people. I'm kind of experimenting like that. And I am connecting, and I'm finding out who potentially are my clients. I mean, I make clients this way. My distance clients, that is. I make my long distance clients this way. Sometimes I make local clients this way too. I might be disqualifying people I don't want to work with, which is another thing that I've learned from studying business this long with you in the mastermind group, is like I might be saying, you know, hey, anyone who finds that my sense of humor is, you know, deplorable for some reason, I probably wouldn't want to work with you anyway. You know, I don't need you right now. I do not need you. I would encourage you instead to, again, have some curiosity, since I'm just trying to start a conversation and I'm finding things fun.
Yeah, you know? Get a little uncomfortable there. Yeah.
And I haven't done like what you've done. I haven't gone up there on stage to deliver a roast to someone. I can aspire to that. I can certainly aspire to get up on stage in general and doing a presentation, kind of like what we're doing right now. Yeah, I want to get people to laugh and I want to get people to think. And I do use the opportunity to connect. I'm finding out who are the people who have those firm conclusions, because they kind of, you know, tip their hand in their comments. You know, they make their firm conclusions well known. That is, of course, a little bit of a warning sign if they were to have any power over my life, you know, or if they were for some reason in a position of power over my life. You know, that is concerning when they have those firm conclusions that are unyielding, that they just want to keep the same way, because that whole thing of feeling uncomfortable, if they were to acknowledge that because they took a certain conclusion that was wrong, minor and possibly major tragedies happened, and they can't bear to face that reality as a possibility. Yeah, those are dangerous people to me. And there are a lot of them out. And I'd like for them to call themselves out a little bit. I like that, actually, approach. I very rarely block anyone on Facebook. It's extremely rare. It's after I tell them to stop, like many, many times, basically. And, you know, I'm glad to be in that position. I don't have really thin skin. I can take a lot, basically, before I actually block someone. And, yeah, I think I've done it 3 times at this point, with this, like, 11 years on Facebook. So, you know, that's very minor. I really do emphasize that type of thing right now. This is, of course, the time where, again, if I'd be hypocritical to be asking for everyone and myself to be more patient and then being less patient with people. I'm still going to be realistic in my assessment to some degree. I'm still going to say, potentially, has this person got a kind of firm conclusions that could be used in a dangerous way? Yeah. Should they have some power over me or others that I care about? And if the answer is yes, that's like a flag, similar to the logical fallacy flags, you know, of that are like, hey, this way you might be going the wrong way, you know. But I'm not going to take it as a for sure stamped in stone that this is an awful person or they're a dangerous person. They're just saying this thing right now.
Yeah, there's that. And that, you know, your patience is a limited resource. So be careful where you spend it. You could find that you've been misallocating patience, or what I think is much more common, you are impatient in the places where you feel like it's safe to be impatient, right? Like with family, you know, or other loved ones.
Yeah.
Actually looking at patience as a resource and deciding very carefully where to spend it is important too.
That's the cost-benefit analysis. The important thing with any resource is, what's it going to cost you to give it?
Right.
And what's it going to benefit you to give it? And when it comes to the realm of words and just a few seconds of my time, it, as I've noticed, because I put less of an emphasis on needing to be right and certain, I find that it costs less to give a few kind words to someone, or certainly to not say, I would say, inflammatory or nasty words to someone, you know? Like, I try to make sure, that's another thing on Facebook. You're not going to find me like bad mouthing someone or name calling in general. And if you know, if I ever did, you know, I'd be like the first person to be ready to be called out on that, because that's opposite what my mission is. You know, my mission statement of making a world of abundance, of increased abundance, including intact people who can make more and more win-win choices, and reducing the scarcity of damaged people who make win-lose choices, so as to turn obstacles into opportunities, basically, like that. Like, I keep in mind like what I'm doing while I'm doing it, and I keep in mind what the cost is and the benefit.
Okay, so obstacles into opportunities actually prompts me to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, and we'll end this hour with this. Stoicism.
Okay.
Lots of bad things have happened in my life. I was prepared for none of them. And one of the really valuable takeaways that I got from people like Tim Ferriss or Ryan Holiday, or on the most personal level, Bill Buepert, who I did a series with about Stoicism in 2014, is taking the time to live in what we described as a worst case scenario. You know, like, I worry when if we don't set it up, and we didn't set this up, and it's fine because we're saying it now. When we're talking about the worst case of scenario about something, this isn't some kind of doom porn mental masturbation exercise that you're doing. There is something really, really valuable about experiencing what can go wrong, not dwelling on it, not obsessing about it, but understanding how bad something can be, whether it's personal or there are many aspects of it that are even outside of your sphere of control, and sort of processing in a proactive way, like what your response would be. So I just wanted to hear you talk about that before we wrap up this part.
It's an opportunity to step into the process called negative visualization. And that is visualizing this worst case scenario, or like definitely worse than what you see evidence for, just in case. As an example, people are dying of things that I still don't know what they are dying of, but you know, I'm open to the idea that they could be dying of this and they could be dying of that. The worst case scenario is, what if a whole lot more people were dying such that I actually see evidence of it happening near me? You know, two people that I know even, meaning that would be very traumatic and change. And so the stepping into it is, I visualize that going on, and how do I handle it mentally? My mental and intellectual impact. You know, do I still maintain my trivium method of critical thinking? Am I still going to gather grammar evidence and knowledge, who, what, where, when? Am I still going to look for logical fallacies and try to piece together a theory of logic and conclusions that show me what could potentially be going on? Am I going to put those two together to make practical applications for taking action? That's like intact. What's my emotional terrain? Am I going to go through the quadrants, the thoughts that I'm having, the observations I'm taking in, the feelings that I notice? Am I going to notice the qualities called needs in NVC lingo? You know, these qualities that I seek, am I going to pin them to the thoughts and the feelings? Am I going to balance my emotional terrain that way and take action that goes along with balancing those, that terrain? Am I going to really, you know, have that practical application, you know, according to, say, getting things done, the David Allen methodology of just knowing what my objectives are, you know, in this case, staying safe, healthy, right, and prosperous, and what are the actions that I need to achieve those objectives? And then what am I going to, you know, what resources do I need to effectively take those actions to achieve my objectives? I need to have them stacked like that. And I spend some time with my students, as I have like, you know, students where I go over the mental emotional skill sets that I just described in the last couple minutes. And yeah, we did visualize some worst case scenarios. I mean, you want to hear about that? Or?
Yeah, sure.
So worst case scenario is like that. A lot more people start dying. And we were just speculating, well, where is it likely to happen? And it was like, likely not happening first on Hawaii, right, Island, you know, a population of under 200,000. It could be multiple places at once, but it would probably not be here first, you know, or right along with the first wave. So yeah, like just the exercise was, how am I mentally dealing with it? And I was mostly feeling pretty intact there. I was certainly feeling the emotional response of the fear, you know, of like, am I going to have to be, you know, left without income? And now I'm going to literally have to go into the jungle with a tent. Is that how far it's going to go? You know, how far do I have to go here? You know, am I ready for that? Am I ready to live off the land again? No, not again. I'm sorry, yeah, for the first time ever. But again, in my mind, you know, that's what I mean. Like, I've only been fantasizing about survival and preparedness for the last 12 years. Like, I still have that mental, emotional impact of that. What I was taught to do by the people who are really good at survival and preparedness is to think of it like a camping trip. We're all going camping, you know, and now relax into it, because I've had really wonderful times going camping, you know. And still, you know, when the fears or the sadness or the frustration pops up, to go back and manage that part of that quadrant in that realm of my existence, and look at it and connect it to the things that I know would help me get back to balance. So I have these specific skill sets that we covered in, I guess, that first Trivium meets NBC shows, you know, like I've got the skill sets, I've honed them for these years that since we've did those shows. And I got my methodology of that. And I definitely saw the distress on my student's face as he was, you know, first starting to entertain these ideas, where we're trying to figure out, you know, like, because death can be happening in lots of different ways and everyone's in hysteria. There's no one who's going to stop and say, wait, I want to see the research, right, paper that proves,
right,
this. They're going to just be ready to accept solutions, because that's what traumatic, you know, conditioned people do. What I choose to do will be different. because I want to do something a little bit more proactive. And when Bill Buppert went over negative visualization in the show with you, I kept it well in mind, saying, okay, and I kind of have been preparing for this moment to some degree. What am I going to do? How am I going to manage my mental terrain, my emotional terrain, my logistical and tactical terrain? What are the steps that I'm going to take? And we started laying out who is likely to be really prepared to survive. And we named a mutual friend, me and my student, we named a friend who's about 30 minutes drive away from here, which would be a pretty fair distance, long day yeah. walk to get to if we had to. We came up with the idea that it would be a good idea to reestablish a closer connection with her because she's really set up to be prepared for this kind of situation. What if I was hit with more? What if they turn on the tsunami machine? And what am I going to do with each of these situations? And I just, again, it was just a moment to take in the mental terrain and how does that impact my thinking? I need to see how am I going to think clearly in that case. How does it impact my emotional terrain? And then what are my steps of action?
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll continue next week.
Walk me out in the morning. Do my money. Walk me out in the morning. Do today. Never see the